You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want you all to close your eyes, assuming that you're sitting in a comfortable chair. Please lean back, relax, close your eyes, and let the years roll away. Tonight, we're taking you back in time to the golden age of radio. You're sitting in your parlor in front of your cathedral radio set and waiting breathlessly to hear a speech by the president in front of a special session of Congress. One of only 20-some-odd special sessions of Congress that had ever been called in the history of the nation up to that time. Keep your eyes closed and listen very, very carefully.
This is the 25th time that Congress has had a special session since its organization 150 years ago. John Adams was the first president to call a special session. He summoned the Fifth Congress to meet on May 15th in 1797 to consider suspension of diplomatic relations with France. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison each found it necessary to call two extraordinary sessions, and Mr. Lincoln called another just before the Civil War. The greatest number of special sessions have been summoned by Woodrow Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt, three each. Mr. Roosevelt's first extraordinary session of Congress was in March of 1933 to pass emergency New Deal laws. The second was in October of 1937 to enact the social, labor, and farm legislation, and this special session that has convened today makes the third. Right now, the members of the House and the Senate are all sitting quietly in their seats. The galleries, as to be expected, are filled to overflowing, and standees are standing at all of the doors. The presidential box is directly opposite us across the full length of the House, and it's very hard to recognize anybody sitting in the box from here, but we can see some of the presidential confidential secretaries, Miss Grace Tully, and I believe Miss LeHand is up there, too. Outside of that, all of the boxes, right up to the very edge of the standing room, are filled to overflowing, and although the scene is not as bright as it was on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of the Congress, last spring, the color is still there. There are many ladies in the audience, and they're all dressed in bright new autumn clothes. Colonel Starling, the chief of the White House Secret Service, has just come in the door immediately to the right of the rostrum and has spoken to some of the members of the Secret Service standing there, so we can expect now that the president will be here shortly. An hour before the scheduled convocation of Congress this morning and 3 hours before President Roosevelt's speech, vantage points up here in the galleries of the House where the joint session is to be held were taken over by newsreels and still cameramen. Even then, a few spectators with the coveted passes that entitled them to seats arrived. That was at 11 o'clock this morning. At that time, your reporter was here, and there were only two members on the floor itself, and they were Representatives Curtis and Graham. Both, incidentally, are among the few who have established perfect attendance records at the last session. Microphones were put in their places, and automobile parking in the plaza in front of the Capitol was banned. 2 hours ago, also, large crowds of spectators began to trek across the lawns and take up vantage points near the entrance to the House so that they might see the president as he arrived. Over on the Senate side, your reporter was there this morning, too, before this Congress was convened to hear the president's address. Vice President Garner was at his office very early, we were told, and was talking about his pecan crop and the bantam chickens in Uvalde, Texas, where he lives. A few senators, including Senator McCarran of Nevada, meticulously attired in a cutaway, strolled about the chamber. And the Senate gallery, strangely, were crowded, although the Senate's only task was to march to the House chamber to hear the President's message. Page boys, who had had their vacations interrupted by the special session, were making very sure that the senator's ink wells were filled and the pen points and pens and such things were in place for a busy week, or perhaps the busy weeks which are to follow. Now the House is sitting there in order, waiting for the President to come in, and we've just received a signal that the President has started down the corridor, which leads directly into the House itself. And we can expect Mr. Roosevelt to come through the door leading to the speaker platform in just a moment. At that time, of course, the whole House will rise, and undoubtedly we will hear an ovation from Mr. Roosevelt. There always is one when he comes into this House to speak before the two sessions of Congress. Speaker Bankhead and Vice President Garner are presiding jointly, of course, over this joint session. As I told you, they are sitting together up where the speaker normally sits alone. That is a marble dais which is in back of the speaker's rostrum in itself, where President Roosevelt will make his speech. Up overhead, the sun is shining brightly through the glassed-in window, and we can see the famed coffin that is the speaker for the House amplifying system. And now Colonel Starling is coming through the side entrance to the House of Representatives, and President Roosevelt can be seen through the door going down the corridor with Secretary Early. Mr. Bankhead has just announced the President of the United States, and here's the ovation for the President. You can hear the ovation. Colonel Starling has just gone up and tested the speaker's platform to be sure that it was sturdily filled. And President Roosevelt, with the two committees, one from the House and one from the Senate, is walking slowly up the ramp. Now you can hear the shouts and the roar of the crowd as President Roosevelt starts to walk up towards the speaker's platform on the arm of Brigadier General Watson, his secretary. Behind him is his bodyguard, Tom Salters, and the two committees now are being conducted off the speaker's dais and back to their seats. Vice President Garner has shaken hands with some of the members of the committee, and both the Vice President and Mr. Bankhead are smiling and saying a few words to Mr. Roosevelt as he walks towards the speaker's platform. The ovation continues for the President as he stands there and now lifts his splendid head to smile at the crowd in his usual manner. He stands there quietly for a moment, and in just a minute now, President Roosevelt will begin his speech. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, I have asked the Congress to reassemble in extraordinary session in order that it may consider and act on the amendment of certain legislation, which in my best judgment so alters the historic foreign policy of the United States that it impairs the peaceful relations of the United States with foreign nations. At the outset, I proceed on the assumption that every member of the Senate and of the House of Representatives and every member of the executive branch of the government, including the President and his associates, personally and officially, are equally and without reservation in favor of such measures that will protect the neutrality, the safety, and the integrity of our country, and at the same time, keep us out of war. Because I am wholly willing to ascribe an honorable desire for peace to those who hold different views from my own as to what those measures should be, I trust that these gentlemen will be sufficiently generous to ascribe equally lofty purposes to those with whom they disagree. Let no man or group in any walk of life assume exclusive protectorate over the future well-being of America, because I conceive that regardless of party or section, the mantle of peace, the mantle of patriotism, is wide enough to cover us all. Let no group assume the exclusive label of the peace bloc. We all belong to it. I have at all times kept the Congress and the American people informed of events and trends in foreign affairs. I now review them in a spirit of understatement. Since 1931, the use of force instead of the council table has constantly increased in disputes between nations, except in the Western Hemisphere, where in all those years there has been only one war, now happily terminated. During those years also, the building up of vast armies and navies and storehouses of war has proceeded abroad with growing speed and intensity. But during these years, and extending back even to the days of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the United States has constantly, consistently, and conscientiously done all in its power to encourage peaceful settlements, to bring about reduction of armaments, and to avert threatened wars. We have done this not only because any war anywhere necessarily hurts American security and American prosperity, but because of the more important fact that any war anywhere retards the progress of morality and religion and impairs the security of civilization itself. For many years, the primary purpose of our foreign policy has been that this nation and this government should strive to the utmost to aid in avoiding war among nations. But if and when war unhappily comes, the government and the nation must exert every possible effort to avoid being drawn in to the war. The executive branch of the government did its utmost within our traditional policy of non-involvement to aid in averting the present appalling war. Having thus striven and failed, this government must lose no time or effort to keep our nation from being drawn in. In my candid judgment, we shall succeed in those efforts. We are proud of the historical record of the United States and of all the Americas during all these years, because we have thrown every ounce of our influence for peace into the scale of peace. I note in passing what you will all remember, the long debates of the past on the subject of what constitutes aggression, on the methods of determining who the aggressor might be, and on who the aggressor in past wars had been. Academically, this may have been instructive, as it may have been of interest to historians to discuss the pros and the cons and the rights of the wrong and wrongs of the World War during the decade that followed it. But in the light of problems of today, problems of tomorrow, responsibility for acts of aggression is not conceived. And the writing of the record can safely be left to future historians. There has been sufficient realism in the United States to see how close to our own shores came dangerous paths which were being followed on other continents. Last January, I told the Congress that a war which threatened to envelop the world in flames has been averted, but it has become increasingly clear that peace is not assured. By April last, new tensions had developed. A new crisis was in the making. Several nations with whom we had had friendly, diplomatic, and commercial relations had lost or were in the process of losing their independent identity and their very sovereignty. During the spring and summer, the trend was definitely toward further acts of military conquest and away from peace. As late as the end of July, I spoke to members of the Congress about the definite possibility of war. I should have called it the probability of war. And last January also, I spoke to this Congress of the need for further warning of new threats of conquest, military and economic, a challenge to religion, to democracy, and to international good faith. I said an ordering of society which relegates religion, democracy, and good faith among nations to the background can find no place within it for the ideals of the Prince of Peace. The United States rejects such an ordering and retains its ancient faith. And I said, we know what might happen to us of the United States if the philosophies of force were to encompass the other continents and invade our own. We, no more than other nations, can afford to be surrounded by the enemies of our faith and our humanity. Fortunate it is, therefore, that in this Western Hemisphere, we have under a common ideal of democratic government a rich diversity of resources and of peoples functioning together in mutual respect and peace. And last January, in the same message, I also said, we have learned that when we deliberately try to legislate neutrality, our neutrality laws may operate unevenly and unfairly, may actually give aid to an aggressor and deny it to the victim. The instinct of self-preservation should warn us that we ought not to let that happen anymore. And it was because of what I foresaw last January from watching the trend of foreign affairs and their probable effect upon us that I recommended to the Congress in July of this year that changes be enacted in our neutrality law. The essentials for American peace in this war-torn world, have not changed since last January or last July. And that is why I ask you again to re-examine our own legislation. Go back a little. Beginning with the foundation of our constitutional government in the year 1789, the American policy in respect to belligerent nations, with one notable exception, was based on international law. Be it remembered that what we call international law has always had as its primary objective the avoidance of causes of war and the prevention of the extension of war. The single exception to which I refer was the policy adopted by this nation during the Napoleonic Wars, when, seeking to avoid involvement, we acted for some years under the so-called Embargo and Non-Intercourse Acts. That policy turned out to be a disastrous failure. First, because it brought our own nation close to ruin, and second, because it was the major cause of bringing us into active participation in European wars in our own War of 1812. And it is merely reciting history to recall to you that one of the results of the policy of embargo and non-intercourse was the burning in 1814 a part of this capital in which we are assembled today. Our next deviation by statute from the sound principles of neutrality and peace through international law did not come for 130 years. It was the so-called Neutrality Act of 1935, only 4 years ago, an act continued in force by the joint resolution of May 1st, 1937. Despite grave doubts expressed as to its wisdom by many senators and representatives and by officials charged with the conduct of our foreign relations, including myself, I regret that the Congress passed that act. I regret equally that I signed that act. On July 14th of this year, I asked the Congress in the cause of peace and in the interest of real American neutrality and security to take action to change that act. I now ask again that such action be taken in respect to that part of the Act which is wholly inconsistent with ancient precepts of the laws of nations, the embargo provisions. I ask it because they are, in my opinion, most vitally dangerous to American neutrality, American security, and above all, American peace. These embargo provisions, as they exist today, prevent the sale to a belligerent by an American factory, the sale of any completed implements of war. But they allow the sale of many types of uncompleted implements of war, as well as all kinds of general material and supply. They furthermore allow such products of industry and agriculture to be taken in American flag ships to belligerent nations. There in itself, under the present law, lies definite danger to our neutrality and our peace. From a purely material point of view, what is the advantage to us in sending all manner of articles across the ocean for final processing? Final processing there, when we could give employment to thousands by doing it here. Incidentally, and again, from the material point of view, by such employment here, we automatically aid in building up our own national defense. And if abnormal profits appear in our midst, even in time of peace, as a result of such an increase of our industries, I feel certain that the subject will be adequately dealt with at the coming regular session of the Congress. Let me set forth the present paradox of the existing legislation in its simplest terms. If prior to 1935 a general war had broken out in Europe, the United States would have sold to and bought from belligerent nations such goods and products of all kinds as the belligerent nations with their existing facilities and geographical situations were able to buy from us or sell to us. This would have been the normal practice under the age-old doctrines of international law. Our prior position accepted the facts of geography, the facts of conditions of land power and sea power and air power alike, as they existed in all parts of the world. If a war had broken out in Europe in 1935, there would have been no difference, for example, between our exports of sheets of aluminum and airplane wings. Today, there is an artificial legal difference. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the export of cotton and the export of gun cotton. Today, there is. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the shipment of brass tubing in pipe form and brass tubing in shell form. Today, there is. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the export of a motor truck and an armored motor truck. Today, there is. Let us be factual. Let us recognize that a belligerent nation often needs wheat and lard and cotton for the survival of its population just as much as it needs anti-aircraft guns and anti-submarine depth charges. Let those who seek to retain the present embargo position be wholly consistent. Let them seek new legislation to cut off cotton and copper and meat and wheat and 1,000 other articles from all of the nations at war. Yet I seek a greater consistency. A greater consistency through the repeal of the embargo provisions and a return to international law. I seek reenactment of the historic and traditional American policy, which, except for the disastrous interlude of the embargo and non-intercourse laws, more than a century and a quarter ago, has served us well from the very beginning of our constitutional existence. It has been erroneously said that return to that policy might bring us nearer war. I give to you my deep and unalterable conviction, based on years of experience as a worker in the field of international peace, that by the repeal of the embargo, the United States will more probably remain at peace than if the law remains as it stands today. I say this because with the repeal of the embargo, this government clearly and definitely will insist that American citizens and American ships keep away from the immediate perils of the actual zones of conflict. And so, I think the repeal of the embargo and a return to international law are the crux of the issue that faces us. The enactment of the embargo provisions did more than merely reverse our traditional policy. It had the effect of putting land powers on the same footing as naval powers, so far as seaborne commerce was concerned. A land power which threatened war could thus feel assured, assured in advance, that any prospective sea power antagonist would be weakened through denial of its ancient right to buy anything anywhere. This, 4 years ago, began to give a definite advantage to one belligerent as against another, not through his own strength or geographical position, but through an affirmative act on the part of the United States. Removal of the embargo is merely reverting to the sounder international practice and pursuing in time of war, as in time of peace, our ordinary trade policies. This will be liked by some and disliked by others, depending on the view they take of the present war. But that is not the issue. The step I recommend is to put this country back on a solid footing of real and traditional neutrality. When and if, I don't like even to mention the word if, I'd rather say when the repeal of the embargo is accomplished, certain other phases of policy reinforcing American safety should be considered. And while nearly all of us are in agreement on their objectives, the only question relates to method. I believe that American merchant vessels should as far as possible be restricted from entering war zones. But war zones may change so swiftly and so frequently in the days to come that it is impossible to fix them permanently by act of Congress. Specific legislation may prevent adjustment to constant and quick change, and it seems therefore more practical to delimit the actual geography of these war zones through action of the State Department and administrative agencies. The objective of restricting American ships from entering such zones may be attained by prohibiting such entry by the Congress, or the result can be substantially achieved by executive proclamation that all such voyages are solely at the risk of the American owners themselves. The second objective is to prevent American citizens from traveling on belligerent vessels, or traveling in danger areas. This can be accomplished also, either by legislation, through continuance in force of certain provisions of existing law, or by proclamation making it clear to all Americans that any such travel is at their own risk. The third objective, requiring the foreign buyer to take transfer of title in this country to commodities purchased by belligerents, is also a result that can be attained by legislation or substantially achieved through due notice by proclamation. The fourth objective is the preventing of war credits to belligerents. This can be accomplished by maintaining in force existing provisions of law, or by proclamation making it clear that if credits are granted by American citizens to belligerents, our government will take no steps in the future to relieve them of risk or loss. The result of these last two objectives will be to require all purchases to be made in cash and cargoes to be carried in the purchaser's own ships at the purchaser's own risk. Two other objectives have been amply attained by existing law. namely regulating collection of funds in this country for belligerents, and the maintenance of a license system covering import and export of arms, ammunition, and implements of war. Under present enactments, such arms cannot be carried to belligerent countries on American vessels, and this provision should not be disturbed. The Congress, of course, should make its own choice of the method by which these safeguards are to be attained. So long as the method chosen will meet the needs of new and changing day-to-day situations and dangers. To those who say that this program would involve a step toward war on our part, I reply that it offers far greater safeguards than we now possess or have ever possessed to protect American lives and property from danger. It is a positive program for giving safety. This means less likelihood of incidents and controversies which tend to draw us into conflict, as they unhappily did before the last World War. There lies the road to peace. The position of the executive branch of the government is that the age-old and time-honored doctrine of international law, coupled with these positive safeguards, is better calculated than any other means to keep us out of war. In respect to our own defense, you are aware that I have issued a proclamation setting forth a national emergency in connection with the observance, safeguarding, and enforcement of neutrality and the strengthening of the national defense within the limits of peacetime authorizations. This was done solely to make fully constitutional and legal certain obviously necessary measures. I have authorized increases in the personnel of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, increases which will bring all four of them to a total still below peacetime strength as authorized by the Congress. I have authorized the State Department to use for the repatriation of Americans caught in the war zone the sum of $500,000 already authorized by the Congress. I have authorized the addition of 150 persons to the Department of Justice to be used in the protection of the United States against subversive foreign activities within our border. At this time, I ask for no further authority from the Congress. At this time, I see no need for further executive action under the proclamation of limited national emergency. Therefore, I see no impelling reason for the consideration of other legislation at this extraordinary session of the Congress. It is, of course, possible that in the months to come, unforeseen needs for further legislation may develop, but they are not imperative today. These perilous days demand cooperation between us without a trace of partisanship. our acts must be guided by one single hard-headed thought: keeping America out of this war. In that spirit, I am asking the leaders of the two major parties in the Senate and the House of Representatives to remain in Washington between the close of this extraordinary session and the beginning of the regular session on January 3rd, 1940. They have assured me that they will do so, and I expect to consult with them at frequent intervals on the course of events in foreign affairs and on the need for future action in this field, whether it be executive or legislative action. And further, in the event of any future danger to the security of the United States, or in the event of need for any new legislation of importance, I will immediately reconvene the Congress in another extraordinary session. I should like to be able to offer the hope that the shadow over the world might swiftly pass. I cannot. The facts compel my stating with candor that darker periods may lie ahead. The disaster is not of our making. No act of ours engendered the forces which assault the foundations of civilization. And yet, we find ourselves affected to the core. Our currents of commerce are changing. Our minds are filled with new problems. Our position in world affairs has already been altered. In such circumstances, our policy must be to appreciate in the deepest sense the true American interest. Rightly considered, this interest is not selfish. Destiny first made us with our sister nations on this hemisphere, joint heirs of European culture. Fate seems now to compel us to assume the task of helping to maintain in the Western world a citadel wherein that civilization may be kept alive. The peace, the integrity, and the safety of the Americas, these must be kept firm and serene. In a period when it is sometimes said that free discussion is no longer compatible with national safety, may you, by your deeds, show the world that we of the United States are one people, of one mind, one spirit, one clear resolution, walking before God in the light of the living.
Thus, the President of the United States concludes his address, reviewing the neutrality laws of the country before a joint meeting of the newly convened special session of Congress in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. In just a few minutes, the joint session of the Congress will be adjourned, and the respective houses are expected to convene again on Monday. The applause for the President continues as he slowly turns from the Speaker's platform to go out of the door and out of the Capitol building. We expect to be back here at the Capitol shortly for some important news. This is John Charles Daly speaking from the House of Representatives in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. We return you now to our New York studios.
While the President of the United States was addressing both houses of Congress, Premier Daladier began a message to the people of France. Later, our translator, who has been listening to the speech over shortwave radio, will give you a free resume of the entire message. In the meantime, we will listen to Premier Daladier's concluding remarks. We take you now to Paris.
Bretagne, ou en Alsace. Elle ne renouvelle pas ses méthodes. Elle cherche partout des singes incartes pour trahir leur patrie. Elle espère trouver des hachas pour en scier la déchéance et en consacrer la servitude. Mais la France tout entière s'est dressée. Il n'y a pas chez nous de traître, mais un peuple unanime, courageux, résolu, qui inscrit sur ses drapeaux la liberté ou la mort. Après tant de mensonges et tant de reniements, la propagande allemande n'a plus maintenant qu'un dernier espoir. Celui de dissocier les forces qui vont briser sa marche vers la domination du monde. Il est clair que la propagande allemande n'a plus maintenant que deux objets. Elle veut séparer la France de l'Angleterre. Elle veut désunir les Français entre eux. Mais quand les Français entendent les ondes ennemies leur dire que cette guerre est la guerre de l'Angleterre, ils répondent non, c'est la guerre d'Hitler. Comment faire croire à des Français qui, depuis des mois, sentent grandir le péril sur leurs propres frontières, qu'ils font la guerre pour la Grande-Bretagne? La propagande allemande a tort de ne pas changer de procédé quand elle déborde le territoire du Reich. Les Français connaissent par l'expérience, autant que par le sentiment, la valeur de l'amitié britannique. Ils voient la marine de l'Angleterre casser et détruire les sous-marins allemands, ses avions combattre dans notre ciel, ses fils, non plus volontaires, mais soldats par devoir, rejoindre les soldats de France aux frontières de notre patrie. Ils savent aussi qu'un même idéal de liberté et de dignité humaine fait battre le cœur de la France, de l'Angleterre et des centaines de millions d'hommes qui, dans leurs empires immenses, dévouent toute leur force à la cause commune. La radio hitlérienne veut reprendre ce thème à l'infini. Pas un Français ne peut en être dupe. Plus ridicule encore est l'espoir de dresser des Français contre leur patrie. Monsieur Goebbels, ou son successeur, veut faire entendre à sa radio des voix de femmes qui prétendent parler au nom des mères françaises. Ces employés de sa propagande peuvent lire leur appel, qui n'est qu'une offense à la douleur des mères véritables. Un Français déshonoré, traître à son pays, peut s'apitoyer dans les studios allemands sur le destin de nos soldats. Aucun d'entre vous ne peut être pris à des pièges aussi grossiers. Ce chantage aux sentiments les plus nobles ne fait que soulever votre dégoût et que raffermir votre volonté. Car la propagande allemande a pu mentir sur tout, mais il est une chose sur laquelle elle ne saurait vous tromper, vous abuser, c'est votre amour pour la France. L'amour de la France a renouvelé le miracle qui assura notre salut chaque fois que nous avons été en péril. Dans l'épreuve, notre communauté nationale devient de jour en jour plus ardente et plus fraternelle. Nous faisons la guerre parce que nous ne voulons pas que la France soit asservie. Pour son salut, nous mettrons en œuvre toutes nos forces. Nous continuerons à prendre toutes les mesures d'ordre intérieur, de discipline, d'économie, afin que le pays tout entier participe à l'effort commun. Nous ne permettrons pas que certains s'enrichissent pendant que d'autres donneraient leur sang. Nous sommes calmes et résolus. Nous ne sommes pas hantés, comme nos ennemis, par la crainte d'une guerre longue. Nous ne pensons qu'à une chose, à la victoire totale. Cette victoire, nous la considérerons comme acquise. Dès que nous pourrons créer, fonder la paix sur des bases solides, dès que nous pourrons enfin apporter à la France la sécurité définitive que les entreprises hitlériennes lui ont retirée depuis 3 années. L'épreuve est dure. Les sacrifices seront douloureux. Mais la France a vaincu de plus grands périls. Nul n'a jamais pu la détruire. Et il vient toujours une heure où les forces morales qui font l'armature des grandes nations pacifiques leur donnent la victoire. Ces forces morales, elles animent toutes nos armées que le péril n'a pas prises au dépourvu. Elles ont les moyens qui permettent de résister et de vaincre. Elles ont le courage, elles ont la science, elles ont la foi. Elles combattent pour l'indépendance et la sécurité de notre patrie et pour en finir à tout jamais avec les entreprises de domination de l'Allemagne. La France n'a pas pris les armes pour incendier des villes, livrer à la mort des femmes et des enfants, torturer des hommes sans défense. Elle a pris les armes pour une cause juste et humaine, et c'est pour cela qu'elle aura la victoire.
Mesdames, Messieurs, vous venez d'entendre M. Édouard Deladier, président du Conseil des ministres.
From Paris, CBS has brought you the voice of Premier Deladier addressing a message to the people of France. In our studios in New York, translators have been copying the message in English, and now, in just a moment, we'll present a free resume of what Premier Deladier said. Are you ready, sir?
Monsieur Deladier, French Prime Minister, said that for 20 days France has been at war. I want to tell you, he said, of the military and diplomatic conditions of our fight. I want to tell you, soldiers of France, what your duty is. You are a nation of free men, and you must remain free men always. I have just visited the front and seen our positions on German territory. I have seen the value and the intelligence and skill of our high command, which avoids every temptation of sending its men forward recklessly and having them slaughtered. I have admired our soldiers. I have seen with emotion and am proud of our gallant soldiers who fight because Germany has tried to use force against us, and we want to be finished once and for all with this atmosphere of threat and force. We must fight this force that tries to crush France. The Hitler domination already exercises a reign of terror over Germany. German domination has also crushed Poland, but before Poland also Czechoslovakia and Austria. The efforts of all those who have tried for peace because the destruction of Poland was prepared in advance by the threat of force and secret treaties, positions were gained, but now Poland not only has given herself up in martyrdom, but has shown heroism after her first defeats, because her mobilization was not complete when the German mechanized divisions marched through her territory. Poland consolidated her resistance later along shortened lines, but the German motorized divisions were too strong. Russia also came into the fight through a secret pact. The division of Poland was decided upon by Russia and Germany. Hitler had the precious contract, that is, the contract with Russia, in his hands before he even attacked Poland. What man of honor could be content with Hitler's promises of today, since all his previous pledges he has torn up one by one? In 1934, Hitler said that Germany would respect the Locarno Pact, but in 1936, he occupied the Rhineland. Later, he told the world that Germany would never annex Austria. Then he did annex Austria. On the 26th of September, he said the Sudetens were the last problem to be resolved by Germany. But on the 29th of September, at Munich, he promised us, and me personally, that he would not annex the Czechoslovaks because he wanted only, he said, the purity of the German race. But on March 13th, Prague was occupied. Bohemia was reduced to servitude. Later, Hitler said that Germany considered Poland's frontiers were permanent and irrevocable. Now, after tearing up Poland, he says that he wants nothing more. He has promised not to touch France, but we know too well that he will do the same thing to us if he can. His ambition is to isolate France from all her friends. Germany is developing her propaganda everywhere. She wants to separate our provinces, one from the other. But all of France has arisen like one man. There is no traitor among us. We want liberty or death. After so many lies, German propaganda has only now the further hope of separating her enemies and dominating the world. She wants to separate France from England and disunite France among herself. But to all this we reply, no. It is not our war, but Hitler's war. We are fighting for ourselves and for Great Britain. German propaganda is making a great mistake in not changing its tactics. The British fleet, Monsieur Daladier said, and her planes are fighting gallantly, and her soldiers are joining ours for liberty and human dignity. Our two immense empires, that is, the French and British empires, are united. We will not be Hitler's dupes. The German radio, he said, has been using all sorts of tactics, notably that of having women speak, trying to imitate French mothers in order to plead with their sons not to fight. But our soldiers, said Monsieur Daladier, cannot be caught in such a trap. Your dignity, he said, in speaking to the French soldiers, will be aroused. Germany cannot deceive your love for France. The love of France has consecrated our ardor all along the line, he said. We are threatened, and we are fighting not to be slaves. We will take every measure of discipline within our country, said Monsieur Daladier, in order to fight the good fight. We are calm and resolute and are not haunted by the fear of a long war. We want the final victory, and then we want to found a peace on a sound basis. The test will be hard, he warned the French soldiers. The sacrifices will be grievous. But France has always conquered every peril, he said, and with Her moral strength has won every victory. The French army has courage, science, and faith, said Monsieur Daladier. We will finish this time once and for all with Germany's efforts of domination. We are fighting now for justice and humanity, and we will have victory.
You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. This is the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. We have taken you back in time, ladies and gentlemen, to September the 21st, 1939.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was our translator in New York giving you a free resume of the message Premier Daladier delivered to the people of France. The message was begun while President Roosevelt in Washington was addressing both houses of Congress. Now, the latest news from Bucharest, Romania, where Premier Călinescu was shot and killed today. Officially announced in Bucharest that members of the outlawed pro-Nazi Iron Guard killed the Romanian premier. The announcement called the attack cowardly. It said the assassins were arrested. And it said further that a new premier will be sworn in right away in advance of a meeting of the Crown Council with King Carol. Romanian officials said that order prevails throughout the country. The German news agency, meanwhile, says that the Nazis didn't do the deed. Reports received in Bucharest said that Romanian police at Cernoti, which is near the Polish frontier, had raided the German house there, and it was reported it found material outlining the attitude which German residents were to take in the event German troops were to arrive at the Polish-Romanian frontier, a border now manned on the Polish side, not by Germans, but by the troops of the Red Army of Soviet Russia, following the Russian occupation of eastern Poland. Bulletin, Paris. Germans today subjected French positions on the Western Front to the heaviest shelling of the war. Here are just a few more dispatches. Berlin, the Romanian legation says an army leader, General Ernst Balif, has been named to replace Premier Călinescu. This indicates a strongly militant government in this pivotal Balkan kingdom. Romanian officials say they will enforce a rigid policy of neutrality. Paris. Europe's western battlefront is quiet today, but it may be only the lull before the storm. Troops are on the march in both France and Germany, moving up to bulwark front lines. France has now completed general mobilization with 6 million men under arms, and British troop movements in France continue at a feverish pace. To repeat the bulletin which counteracts that remark that we were just giving you in that dispatch, the Germans today subjected French positions on the western front to the heaviest shelling of the war. A further broadcast on the European situation will be presented by CBS later in the day and evening. There will be a summary of developments as reported by the Press Association at 6 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, and H.P. Kaltenborn will analyze the day's happenings at 6:15. The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present the nightly broadcast of Elmer Davis and the News at 8:55 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Once again, we are speaking from the House of Representatives in the nation's capital. When we returned you to New York some minutes ago, shortly after thereafter, the joint session of the Congress was adjourned, but the House of Representatives stayed convened. Just a minute or two ago, the House of Representatives concluded the business of the day and convened, or rather adjourned, to convene again on Monday. Albert Warner, Columbia's Washington News analyst, is still here in the small library just off the House of Representatives floor and has several more distinguished members of Congress whom he will interview. Albert Warner.
Representative William B. Bankhead of Alabama, Speaker of the House of Representatives, is here with me now. Speaker Bankhead presided with Vice President John Garner at the joint session which has just concluded. Speaker Bankhead, I wonder if you'll tell us a little about the session ahead.
Well, I do not know, sir, that I'm in a position now to give a direct answer to your query as to something about what's going to take place in the session of Congress ahead of us. As all know, we are just convened today, and neither the Democratic nor Republican leaders have had an opportunity yet to fashion or formulate any definite program of action. But I think that I'm justified in assuming that for quite a while at least, The Senate of the United States will be the center of attention as far as legislation is concerned because, as you know, during the last session of the House, we passed through this body the Bloom Bill in modified form, and it's my information that the Senate committee will meet either tomorrow or Saturday to take up consideration of some form of that bill. I do not know how long it will be in committee or when it comes out, how long it will be debated. That's a matter that's entirely to be determined by future developments. You, of course, have just listened to the address of the President of the United States. I'm very happy to say to you that he was received in the House of Representatives by great cordiality and tolerance and respect by both sides of the House, both the Democratic and Republican membership. And I was tremendously impressed with the apparent spirit pervading all members here that for the time at least, partisan politics should be adjourned and that all of us, representing all political groups, should be unified in purpose and in spirit to do all that we can prudently by tolerance and moderation and sound judgment to preserve the peace of the United States and to prevent our being drawn into any war. You're going to be spoken to now by one of my dear friends on the Republican side, Congressman Ditter of Pennsylvania, who I am sure will enlarge somewhat upon the spirit of friendship and harmony as far as national unity is concerned, which I have just undertaken to express. I thank you.
Thank you, Speaker Bankhead. As the Speaker has said, Representative Ditter of Pennsylvania, Chairman of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, and one of the minority leaders of the House, is with us now. Ditter?
I read that. We are at a fateful hour in the history of the American people. Every member of Congress is conscious of that fact. Our deliberations in this session of the Congress may determine whether we follow positively and aggressively the constructive pursuits of peace or allow ourselves to be drawn into the consuming inferno of war. Before such a challenge affecting the destiny of 130 million people, all thought of partisanship gives way to the deepest impulses of patriotism. The heart of America cries aloud for peace. Only calm thinking and deep Americanism will enable us to see clearly through the bellowing fog of alien propaganda to the clear path of national interest. The greatest service, as I see it, that America can render to the world is to keep aglow the beacon light of liberal constitutional government. That light is the hope, and the only hope, I might say, of the world today. At this time, we should support wholeheartedly the President's plea for a unity of purpose. And I feel that that unity of purpose can best be expressed in his own words when he said, and I quote, "Despite what happens in continents overseas, the United States of America shall and must remain. As long ago the father of our country prayed that it might remain unentangled and free." And it's in this spirit that the House of Representatives, Republican and Democrat, convene today to try to solve the great and perplexing problem.
Thank you, Mr. Ditter. We have just heard from Speaker Bankhead of the House of Representatives and Representative Ditter, Chairman of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. Now, we may turn this back to Mr. Davis.
And while Mr. Warner is attempting to contact Mr. Bloom, the representative from New York, it might be interesting to review once again the history of the special sessions of Congress. This session today was the 25th Congress that has had a special session since its organization 150 years ago. John Adams was the first president to call a special session. He summoned the Fifth Congress to meet May 15, 1797, to consider suspension of diplomatic relations with France. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison each found it necessary to call two extraordinary meetings because of the split between the United States and the Great Britain, or rather Great Britain, which led eventually to the War of 1812. Again, Abraham Lincoln called a special session of the 37th Congress on July 4th in 1861, just prior to the war between the states. The greatest number of special sessions had been summoned by Woodrow Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt. That, it means three each. Mr. Wilson, of course, called his special sessions just prior to and during the World War. Mr. Roosevelt's first extraordinary session of Congress was in March of 1933 to pass emergency New Deal laws. The second was in October of 1937 to enact social, labor, and farm legislation. And today's special session was called, as you know, about the neutrality laws. Now, here is Mr. Warner back again with another distinguished member of Congress. Mr. Warner.
We have with us a woman congressman, Representative Norton, Mrs. Norton of New Jersey, chairman of the House Labor Committee. I wonder if you'd tell us a little about what you think will be in store in the session ahead.
Well, I believe that the Congress will abide by the suggestion of the President and shall not consider any legislation other than the legislation concerning the embargo. At least that is my hope. I believe that the Congress is very much impressed by the message delivered by the President, and I think the great majority of us were entirely in favor of all that he had said.
I wonder if you look forward to a long session and to a bitter fight over the arms embargo.
No, I do not. From my conversation with a great many members today, I believe the session will not be long. I believe we may be out of here not later than 3 weeks from now. I hope I'm a prophet.
As I understand it, the House will be going into three-day recesses until the Senate acts.
Yes, of course, the House already has acted upon this legislation. And until the Senate acts upon it, I presume there will be nothing for the House to do but await the will of the Senate. And no doubt, when the bill comes back to us, why, we shall have our day in court.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Norton.
You're very welcome, and thank you very much for asking me to come here.
Mr. Davies.
And thus the Columbia Broadcasting System concludes its broadcast relevant to the address of the President of the United States before a joint session of Congress on the neutrality laws of the country. You have heard the address by President Roosevelt, and prior to his address and following it, Mr. Warner, Columbia's Washington News analyst, interviewed several prominent congressmen. This is John Charles Daly speaking from the House of Representatives in the capital of the United States in Washington, D.C. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
3:10 p.m. BULOVA Bulova Watch Time. Here's a distinguished timepiece, the 21-jewel Bulova President in the charm and color of natural gold. Curved, streamlined. An exceptional value. The broadcast of the baseball game between the Washington Senators and the Cleveland Indians will begin this afternoon at 4 p.m. WJSV, Washington. The career of Alice Blair. The transcribed, true-to-life story of a lovely girl fighting for fame and happiness, facing the problems, the heartaches, and thrills on the ladder to success. At this time every day, Monday through Friday, join Alice Blair in her fascinating career.
It was the poet Wordsworth who said, "The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers." And I'm afraid in many ways he was right, especially where we women are concerned. Our daily whirl of activities, the evenings we're out late, those busy mornings cleaning house, everything conspires to play havoc with our complexion. And goodness knows a woman's complexion is part and parcel of her natural charm. That's why it's so important to guard the skin by proper cleansing I mean with a pure cold cream. Daggett and Ramsdell Perfect Cold Cream. Because Daggett and Ramsdell Perfect Cold Cream removes dirt, dust, and makeup without robbing your skin of a natural oil. For your own fresh attractiveness, use it before you go to bed and then again in the morning. Ask at your drugstore or beauty counter for the big, generous 45-cent jar of Daggett and Ramsdell Perfect Cold Cream.
Alice has had an exciting and eventful afternoon at Mercury Studios. William Waldron, the top director, is to direct Alice in her screen test, and the young actor, Barry Clayton, at his own request, is to play with her in the scene. Both Waldron and Clayton were deeply impressed by the scripts Alice brought to use in the test, and Waldron was more than enthusiastic over Alice's reading of the scene. Of course, she carefully evaded all their questions as to who had written it. For Alice promised Carl Eastwhite she would, under no condition, mention that he was the writer. The feud between Carl and Hollywood is notorious. Home at the apartment. Uncle Andy, waiting for Alice, hears a tap at the door. A tap that becomes more familiar as the days in Hollywood go on.
Yeah, don't need to give myself three guesses who that is.
Is that lady from next door again?
Hello there, Maya.
Hello, Andy. The kettle's on. Come on in and have a cup of nice hot tea.
Hot tea on a day like this?
Of course. Why, there's nothing so refreshing. Come on.
Well, it sounds mighty attractive, but I'm expecting Alice any minute now, and I just don't think I'd better leave.
We could leave the door to my apartment open. Then we'd hear her when she comes upstairs.
Well, I think maybe I'd just better stay here.
Well, everything's all set out, so if you change your mind...
All set out, did you say?
Uh-huh.
Well, come on. I'll come in just for a spell, and we'll leave the door open.
That's fine.
You shouldn't put yourself out this way.
Maybe I like doing it. Now I'll pour the tea.
there's nothing more gracious than a woman presiding over a tea table.
Uh-huh. But a tea table should be set with gleaming silver to make the picture complete.
Oh, I haven't missed the gleaming silver. To me, the picture is already quite complete.
How nice of you.
And there's plenty of time for all that gleaming silver someday when you get a home of your own.
Oh, don't.
Surely you didn't take offense at what I said.
Oh, no, of course not. It's only that the idea of a home is so far from my mind. You see, Andy, I've battled alone and, well... You take two lumps of sugar and no lemon.
No. How did you remember that?
How could I forget it? There you are.
Oh, thank you. You know, it seems to me, even if a woman does follow a career as her life work and chooses to battle through alone, as you say, there's still no reason why she can't have her own home and even have the gleaming silver?
Oh, of course, if her career is a highly successful one. You know, I wonder sometimes if I've chosen the right path. Andy?
Hmm?
I had a chance to go on location for 2 weeks.
Yeah?
I'm not going because of you.
Oh, now, see here, Mary, you can't let us interfere with your work like that.
Can't I? Well, I just couldn't bear to go away for 2 weeks. You don't know what it's meant having you and Alice so close by. Well, for the first time, this little apartment has seemed like a real home to me. I never knew what I was missing before. It's been such fun asking you in for tea, running in and out, asking your advice.
Oh, but, this will have to stop, Myra, if it's to interfere with your work.
Well, it's worth everything. Oh, come on, let's not even think of it. I did it because I wanted to.
Well, I don't like that one bit.
No, not another word about it, do you hear? We're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to be very, very giddy over the weekend. Oh, I have such wonderful plans. Andy, have you ever been to Venice?
To Venice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I shouldn't say I haven't.
Would you like to go with tea?
shouldn't go to Venice.
Oh, you sweet thing. I don't mean to Venice, Italy. Oh. I mean Venice, California.
Oh.
You know, down by the beach.
Oh, yeah.
Like Coney Island.
Oh, well. That's a horse of a different kind.
Andy, you're too wonderful for words. Will you go with me? We'll have a rollicking time.
Well, it sounds a bit giddy for a man of my age.
A man of your age. When you get on a roller coaster, you'll forget there's such a thing as age.
Me on a roller coaster?
Uh-huh.
Oh, the very idea.
Oh, that's just the way you talked about dancing the other night. And you turned out to be the best partner I ever had.
Yeah, well, that's a bit different from a roller coaster.
Oh, you old blasé New Yorker. Of course, I realize that Venice isn't nearly as big as your Coney Island, but things don't have to be big to be cozy, do they?
Not at all. Your apartment, for instance.
It would be such a lot of fun.
Oh, me on a roller coaster, mm-hmm. Zooming through space. I don't know. I just don't take to those things.
Oh, you never know how much you like a thing till you try. And I promise you won't fall out because I'd hang on, oh, very, very tight.
Well, I don't know. I may consider it after all.
If I coax very, very hard.
Well, and you say you would hang on very, very tight?
Uh-huh. Well.
Don't trade or stolen. One uncle.
Is he in here by any
chance? Oh, hello there, Alice.
Hello. Come on in.
We left the door open so I'd hear you when you came.
You mean so I'd hear you?
Heard you laughing clear down the front hall. What's with the joke?
Don't you dare tell.
Oh, no, not in a million years.
Have some tea, Alice.
No, thanks.
Oh, come on, Alice. You sit down and have a cup while you tell us all about what happened today.
Let me pour it for you.
Thanks, I really don't care for any. It's too hot.
Oh, that's just a notion some folks have. That you get all steamed up over a hot drink.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you come right down to it, there's nothing more refreshing on a hot afternoon than a cup of hot tea. Mm-hmm. It cools you off much quicker than a cold drink does. Now, am I right, Mara?
You absolutely are. Come on, Alice, join us.
No, thanks, really. I have to start learning lines anyway. Have to be at the studio at the crack of dawn.
Oh,
want to help me with the lines, Uncle Andy?
Oh, wait till he has another cup of tea, then I'll send him in.
No, I think I've had all that's good for me. And it's been a very stimulating afternoon, Mara, especially the first part.
The first part? Oh, you just wait. I'll show you what real stimulation is. It's a promise, remember?
Oh, I'm remembering all right.
Say, what are you two talking about anyway? What's the big mystery?
Should we let her in on the secret, Mara?
Don't you dare.
No, can't let you in on it. No, sir, you're too young. You wouldn't understand.
That's the hateful kind of a remark you make to a growing child.
Well, enjoy the tea, Mara.
We'll do it again whenever you say the word. See you later.
Oh, I tell you should have tried some of that tea. It really does cool you off.
Being with that woman never cools me off.
Now, see here, chickadee. Don't go off on a tangent.
Gee, good to get home.
Now, I don't know why you rear up the way you do. Mara just put yourself out to be a good friend to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of sad and pathetic. She's been alone so much. Having us here, she said, made the place seem sort of homelike.
Mm-hmm.
I really got a bit upset, though. She turned down a call to go on location for 2 weeks, just so she could be around here and enjoy our company.
Well, that sort of puts us on the spot, doesn't it? What are we supposed to do, stay around and entertain her?
Oh, we'll make it up to her some way.
Say, what was the big secret? You both acted like you'd swallowed a mouse or something.
Oh, no, we didn't anything of the kind.
I heard you laughing when I came up the stairs. What was it, anyway?
Oh, it wasn't anything at all.
Well, if it wasn't anything at all, why don't you tell me what it was?
You're just magnifying the whole thing. It was a little joke that Myra and I had, that's all. Nothing more than that.
Well, why act so mysterious about it?
We weren't doing anything of the kind.
You said yourself, should we let her in on the secret?
Now, see here. Just because you're my favorite niece, is no reason for you to check up on every little thing I'm thinking and every little joke I'm sharing with someone else.
Oh, I'm not checking up on you, Uncle Andy, but we've always done everything together. especially since we've been out here.
Well, there are a lot of things you do that I don't check into, as much as I think they ought to be sometimes. No, sir, you just mind your own business, young lady, and let your uncle have his private life.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had no intention of interfering with your private life.
Oh, no. Don't get huffy, dear.
No, I'm not huffy.
You'll find out in due time what it is we're talking about.
When will I find out?
When it's over and done with, and not before. That innocent little remark is destined to lead to an awful lot of trouble. Is Alice right in her suspicions of Myra? Is Myra out for Uncle Andy? If there's one place on earth where a man looks like a bull in a china shop, that's a beauty parlor. But I was in just such a spot the other afternoon. You see, I had a date with a lovely creature, and because she was going to be late, she told me to meet her there. Did I feel silly and embarrassed? However, I did learn something. Women pay far more attention to their complexions than we men ever realize. And when I spoke to my date about the matter, she said, no woman can afford to neglect her skin. With a man's typically blunt curiosity, I asked her what she used on her complexion. And she replied, if you must know, I always cleanse with Daggett and Ramsdell Perfect Cold Cream. And judging from how fresh and soft and absolutely irresistible her complexion is, I guess there must be something to this idea of cleansing your face with Daggett and Ramsdell Cold Cream every day. Why not try that 25-cent jar? Remember the name Daggett and Ramsdell. The name you can trust. Is Uncle Andy interested in Myra? Or is he, manlike, flattered by her attention? Alice draws her own conclusion when she comes home unexpectedly in tomorrow's exciting, transcribed Career of Alice Blair. Are you faced with no more swimming for a while, no driving your car with the top down, no sitting out in the cool breezes to avoid the heat? These are the sad consequences of having a summer head cold. The summer variety of cold usually hits you in a very uncomfortable spot, the nose. Nothing is as mean or persistent as a stuffed-up nose. You can't stop a cold from running its course, but you don't have to put up with all the discomfort. You can do something about it. Just apply Mistol drops. They're great for relieving the discomfort of a summer head cold. Mistol drops coat the nasal passages with a gentle, soothing oil. Swelling is temporarily relieved. You can breathe easier. Get a bottle of Mistol drops today. And ask your doctor about Mistol drops with ephedrine. Remember, Mistol drops with ephedrine are green. Mistol drops without ephedrine are red. But don't accept substitutes. Be sure you get genuine, soothing Mistol drops, available at all good drugstores.
This is Columbia Station for the nation's capital. WJSB, Washington. Good afternoon. This is your Arrow News reporter with last-minute hit-the-spot news, brought to you four times daily through the courtesy of Arrow Beer and Ale. Arrow beer has that famous flavor that made it a big favorite in Washington and that today makes Arrow the fastest growing beer in the city. You'll like Arrow's fine taste. It's smooth, not sweet. You'll find it better, not bitter. Every bottle always hits the spot. President Roosevelt has just called on Congress to repeal the embargo provisions of the American Neutrality Law. The president asked the legislators to substitute for the embargo a cash-and-carry system of trade with the warring nations. Mr. Roosevelt urged Congress, which was convened in extraordinary joint session, to work with one single hard-headed thought, namely, keeping America out of this war. President Roosevelt's address, together with other activities at the special session of the United States Congress, was covered fully by the Columbia Broadcasting System and station WJFV, ending just a short time ago. It will therefore not be necessary at this time to repeat details already broadcast. Meanwhile, the White House has disclosed that President Roosevelt plans to leave Washington Friday for a weekend at Hyde Park to observe the 85th anniversary of his mother's birth. Mrs. Sarah Delano Roosevelt celebrated her 85th birthday today. Six youthful assassins shot and killed Premier Armand Călinescu of Romania this afternoon. The Premier was a vigorous foe of the pro-Nazi Iron Guard organization. The assassination occurred while the Premier was driving by automobile to the Royal Palace. The Premier was 46 years old. He also held at the time several other cabinet portfolios, including the Ministry of War. During his regime, the government had suppressed the Nazi-minded Iron Guard organization, charging it with terrorism in Romania. Two of the assassins of Premier Călinescu committed suicide by shooting tonight when surrounded in a midtown store, guards cutting off their escape. The Romanian legation in Berlin reports that an army marshal, General Ernest Balis, has been appointed as Romania's new premier. This indicates a strong militant government in the little Balkan kingdom, which has suddenly become a pivotal state in Europe. According to the legation, the cabinet has issued a statement stressing that order prevails throughout the nation despite the assassination of Premier Călinescu. More details of the ill-fated diplomatic steps which led to the outbreak of the new European war were made public by the British government today. A white paper was issued saying that Germany answered Great Britain's ultimatum of September 2nd for withdrawal of Nazi troops from Poland, with a threat to answer any aggressive action on the part of England with the same weapons and in the same form. There's a lot of speculation just now over what is happening at sea. The British government will not comment on reports that the Bremen has been captured by British warships, nor is there any statement about battles at sea, nor an explanation of heavy firing heard off the Danish coast. Radio broadcasts from Warsaw today, according to reports from London, say the beleaguered metropolis still is Polish. Colonel Lipinski, the Poles' official broadcaster, reports that the Poles in Warsaw are carrying on their fight against the Germans and have even scored minor victories in a few Warsaw suburbs. However, Lipinski announces that three flights of 40 German planes did great damage yesterday. He reports that Polish anti-aircraft fire brought down 7 German craft, but he adds that those which were not shot down destroyed what was left of the Royal Castle, the Art Academy's National Museum, and the Central Institute for Physical Training. Jan Paderewski, now in Paris, says Poland's sacrifice has not been in vain. The world-famous Polish pianist and wartime premier of Poland believes his country's resistance has given the Allies time to make the preparations which will lead them to victory. Meanwhile, Europe's western battlefront is quiet today, but it may be only the lull before the storm. Troops are on the march in both France and Germany, moving up to bulwark front lines. France has now completed general mobilization with 6 million men under arms, and British troop movements in France continue at a feverish pace. Listen in again for the Hour News Reporter, brought to you by the Globe Brewing Company, Baltimore, at 5:30 this afternoon. Remember, when you order beer, be sure to ask for Arrow, the beer with the famous flavor. Joe King speaking. This is Columbia Station for the nation's capital. WJSB, Washington.
Dr. Brent, call surgery. Dr. Brent, call surgery. Dr. Brent, call surgery.
Road of Life, the dynamic story of Dr. Jim Brent. Brought to you by the makers of New Chipso, the faster sudsing soap for easy washing.
Dr. Brent, call surgery.
Let me tell you about something that's sensationally new. A wash day soap that in a recent dramatic speed test beat 8 of the most popular wash day soaps in America and beat them to a frazzle.
What's its name?
Here's its name, Chipsaw. It's the new... That's just a thing. Chipsaw. It comes in the same familiar package, but what a difference in the soap.
Oh, I know Chipsaw. It's a swell soap. I use it all the time.
Sorry, but you probably never used this Chipsaw. This new Chipsaw has just been announced after tests that prove things that hundreds of women could hardly believe. Because new Chipsaw has almost incredible speed. Listen, in one series of tests... We put new Chipsaw up against 8 of America's most popular wash day soaps. Hear that? 8 of America's leading wash day soaps. Right then and there. New, faster Sudsin Chipsaw proved that it dissolves up to 66% faster. That it actually makes suds up to 44% faster. In another test, Chipsaw proved that it had terrific jerk-getting power. In still another test... Chipsaw proved that because it wasn't loaded with harsh chemicals or alkalis, that it was safe for colored washables. Try the wash day sensation of 1939, the new faster Sudsin Chipsaw. Find out for yourself that no other wash day soap beats new Chipsaw in safety and power and gives it split-second speed. Now, your dealer now has the new faster Sudsin Chipsaw. So you can get new Chipsaw in the same familiar package today. And now, Road of Life. Today marks the opening of the sensational trial of the people of the state of Illinois versus John McEwen, an 11-year-old boy against whom the grand jury returned an indictment for murder as the first count, manslaughter as the second. A momentous day for the impressionable youngster upon whom it will leave an indelible impression for the rest of his journey along the road of life. The courtroom is filled to capacity with thrill-seeking public. Every onlooker eager for a glimpse of the boy whom they've been discussing and reading about for over a week. The boy whom the newspapers have branded as a criminal. The jury has been selected. 12 men and women who are to hand down a decision after hearing the state's attorney tear the defendant's reputation to shreds. After hearing the human appeal of Mr. Gregory, his counsel, a plea for leniency. And now as we enter the courtroom, we see Butch, bewildered, pathetic, sitting with Mr. Gregory. Judge Gray is about to address the clerk. And as we listen in, we hear...
Swear the jury, Mr. Clerk. Kindly rise and raise your right hand. You and each of you do solemnly swear by the ever-living God that you will well and truly try the issues joined herein and a true verdict render according to the law and evidence.
We do.
All right, Mr. State's Attorney.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. At this time, I would like to offer you my congratulations for having been selected to hear this, which may prove to be a very interesting and unusual case. After having been questioned by myself and the counsel for the defense, we feel that you men and women are of the type who are qualified to hear and judge this cause, which is now going to trial before you. Yours is an important duty, it is obvious. A young boy is on trial before you, and you are to determine fairly and impartially, from the evidence which is given from the witness stand, the guilt or innocence of the defendant. Now, when you hit the jury box, you're not expected to leave all your life's experiences outside the courtroom. You're expected to use the same good sense and judgment that you use in all those experiences. Listen carefully to all the evidence, and based on those experiences and the knowledge which you obtain from them during your lifetime, you will be able to decide whether or not this boy is guilty of the crime with which he has been charged. At this time, I feel it is my duty to warn you that merely because this boy is but 11 years of age, you are not to consider that fact or let it govern your decision. After you've heard all the evidence, the court will instruct you that any infant over 10 years of age may be found guilty of any crime or misdemeanor if the evidence so warrants. I should also at this time like to warn you that the fact that a child is on trial should not affect or arouse your sympathy should the evidence indicate that he is guilty. The defense may, and probably will, no doubt, attempt to play upon your sympathies and to win
what please. I'm going to object to the state's attorney's trying to influence the jury with whatever the case and the defense might be at this time.
The objection is sustained.
Thank you.
Mr. State's Attorney, kindly confine yourself to outlining the case to the jury and remain within the province of an opening statement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I meant no offense. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the question to be weighed is one that must be decided upon consideration of strict right only. If a crime recognized as such by our statute has been committed, if that crime be fixed upon the prisoner at the bar, then it is immaterial what his age is and what ulterior consideration might prompt you to wish that this cup might pass from his lips. Your sworn duty, your obligation as citizens concerned in the preservation of the social order as friends of the law and interested in its preservation, all speak with one voice. And that voice is awfully distinct. Do your duty and let the consequences fall upon those who have recklessly, brutally, and criminally violated the most fundamental laws of society. Who has steeped his hands in the blood of his fellow being and who denies doing so is a wicked homicide.
Your Honor, I don't know why the state's attorney insists on making his speech at this time. I believe that he should be warned to confine himself to the opening statement which Your Honor permitted him to make at this time.
Mr. State's Attorney, proceed with your outline.
Very well, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the prosecution of John McEwan, the defendant, for the crime of murder and the crime of manslaughter. This accusation against the prisoner we expect to sustain by the following evidence. That on the 24th day of August last, John McEwan armed himself with a loaded pistol and with the intent to kill, did fire that pistol at one Margaret Allen, striking her in the right upper chest, and that as a result of that gunshot wound, Margaret Allen died. We intend to show that earlier in the day, this defendant had an argument with Margaret Allen. We intend to show that he sulked around that entire day, that as day grew to an end, the passion to take the life of Margaret Allen grew within the mind and breast of this defendant, and that on the date aforementioned, he turned upon the deceased and inflicted wounds from which Miss Allen died on the fourth day. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the simplest possible statement of the case.
I have avoided the mention of circumstances which will necessarily appear in evidence. If we shall prove these facts by the testimonies we shall bring forward, we will have made out our case. And your duty will be to award that crime the penalties prescribed by law.
Order! Order in the court!
Surgery calling Dr. Brent. And so we leave the courtroom of Judge Gray as the state's attorney finishes his opening statement, which has been of little or no significance to the young boy who sits alternately staring at him, then at his three friends in the front row, Jim, Grandpa, and Dr. Thompson, whose curious expressions give way to reassuring looks as they feel Butch's eyes turn their direction. What will Mr. Gregory have to say when he addresses the court and jury? Be sure to listen tomorrow. Some startling news. News about the new faster sub-drink Gipso, introduced for the first time this week and now at your dealers. News of economy. Ounce for ounce, you need 26% less of the new faster sub-drink Gipso in your tub, washer, or dishpan than the average of 8 of America's most popular wash day soaps. News of speed and power. When we compared the new faster sub-drink Gipso against 8 of America's most popular wash day soaps, it proved that it dissolved up to 66% faster and makes suds up to 44% faster. With the new faster suds and chips all, your white wash will be brilliantly white and you'll still feel fresh and ready for a day's bath. For new faster suds and chips all combines dirt-getting power, real power, with all its speed. And here's the biggest news of all. If you don't agree that new faster sub-drink Gipso gives you everything we've promised, return the unused portion to your dealer and he'll refund your money. Get an economical package of the new faster sub-drink Gipso in the same familiar package today. Mr. Gregory say when he addresses the jury? Is there any way that the attorney can possibly prove to the court that a third person was present at the time of the fatal shooting of Margaret Allen? Be sure to tune in again at the same time tomorrow. Listen to Road of Life. Attention, please, for an important announcement of a change in time for Road of Life. If your community has not been observing daylight saving time, Road of Life will come to you 1 hour later, beginning next Monday, September 25th. However, if your community has been observing daylight saving time, Road of Life will come to you at the same time as today. This is Stuart Metz, speaking for the makers of Chipso and wishing you good afternoon.
Long wear for silk stockings, don't you? Well, the makers of famous hole-proof stockings say, wash every night in ivy flakes. Try this for extra wear from every pair. Wash your stockings every night in pure ivory flakes.
I have a friend that each day's end when tasks are done and pay is ours. The world feels high and not ask why. To love someone, this day is ours.
Crisco presents a thrilling love story entitled This Day Is Ours. Thank you.
Say, here's a tip for all you ladies who expect to enter cake-baking contests this fall. Now listen closely, because I'm going to tell you how to walk off with practically every blue ribbon in the place. And here's how. You just get new Sure Mix Crisco and use it with your regular cake recipe. Why, your cake will be so much higher and lighter and tenderer than any cake you ever made before with any other shortening you can buy that the judge will probably suspect you of trickery. But, lady, it won't be trickery. It'll be the result of the greatest shortening discovery in 29 years. Yes, new Sure Mix Crisco is now vitally different from any other household shortening we know of. Why, it'll even act differently in your mixing bowl. All your ingredients will mix more thoroughly, more completely, and you'll have an entirely new type cake batter that'll give you cakes that are lighter and tenderer than any cake you ever made before. And, oh, boy, what a grand eating cake it'll be. Why, before Procter & Gamble introduced new Sure Mix Crisco, hundreds of cakes were made in the Crisco kitchens. Each cake was measured. Then Sure Mix Crisco cakes baked up higher, as much as 15% higher, depending on the type of cake. And later, that's the kind of cake you can get with new Sure Mix Crisco. Higher, lighter, tenderer cake. Far better eating cake than you've ever made with any other household shortening we know of. Now, when you go to get new Sure Mix Crisco, just ask for Crisco, because this new, vitally improved shortening has been packed in the same familiar Crisco can with the same familiar Crisco label. There's been no change on the outside, but what a change there is in the new Sure Mix Crisco inside. So, why don't you plan right now to enjoy the three wonderful cake-making advantages new Sure Mix Crisco now brings you. Yes, and change to new Sure Mix Crisco today. And now, this day is ours. Late last night, in Mrs. Simpson's boarding house, her lovely face lit by a shaft of moonlight, Eleanor was tense and drawn. Her eyes were heavy and weary from lack of sleep. And when Kurt said goodnight, she said,
"Kurt, I've been thinking of Myrtle and the things she said to me. If I thought I'd ever be as bitter and cynical toward marriage and life, I'd rather be dead, really, I would. Oh, hold me tight, Kurt. Hold me tight because I'm afraid."
It's early the following evening. Kurt has been out looking for work all day, while Eleanor's been sewing and mending her meager wardrobe in preparation for her coming marriage. Now, alone in the front parlor after dinner, they sit in silence, both wrapped in deep thought. Finally, Eleanor looks at the shaggy-headed man she's promised to marry and says,
"Kurt, I feel terrible about last night, really, I do.
Huh?
I shouldn't have gone all to pieces and said what I did."
"Oh, there's nothing wrong with that, Duchess. I'm glad you told me how you feel, because, well, I'm the guy you're going to marry. I'm the guy who ought to know."
"Oh, Kurt, I'm afraid I'm an awful sissy."
"Well, that's okay with me. I don't like hard-boiled women or anything.
But I shouldn't have let little Susan bring me up that way. Well, couldn't help it, Kurt. She sat there and told me exactly how I felt about marrying her without a job or any real hope for the future. She looked right through me like a crystal gazer.
Yeah.
When she explained, she felt the same way just before she married Jimmy. That's what frightened me, Kurt."
"Now, look, Duchess, look. Come here. Relax, will you? Relax. That's better. Now, what are you worried about, huh? You got me, and I got you. Right?"
"Yes. If we don't have anything else, we have that much."
"Sure.
We've got each other, haven't we?"
"Yeah. You know, I'm much of a philosopher, Duchess, but this much I do know. A home, a family, all life has to begin just like we are. Man and woman. Mates. Adam and Eve didn't have anything. No, but all right, didn't they? I don't know my Bible very well, but I can't remember it saying anything about Eve getting bitter and cynical and fed up with married life. I kind of didn't have any money or pretty clothes. Of course, maybe I'm not a good guy like Adam was."
"Oh, yes, you are. At least you're to me."
"Well, then we can't miss. And we won't ever be like Mercer. You're not that tough."
"I don't think Mercer was either before she married Jimmy. I thought so at first, but I don't know, Kurt. That's why I was so scared. Maybe this marriage without money or any hope of money does something to you. It certainly did something to Myrtle.
Now, look, I won't let it do anything to you, Natchez. I promise you.
Kurt, do you think we'll be right in turning down Miss Farnsworth's job?
Oh, we don't want to wait a whole year to get married, do we, Natchez? Huh?
No, I guess not, Kurt. I don't.
Of course.
Who's this?
Huh? Oh, hello, Kurt.
Hello. Hello, Jimmy.
Who's going out here? No, she isn't, Jimmy. I think she's out playing off that euchre tournament that you had last night. She tied with a Garfield Flash and upset the whole euchre world.
Oh,
Kurt,
you clown.
Of course she did. Eleanor, look, I hate to bother you with this, but will you know Myrtle and you talk to her? You've seen the way she's been acting.
Jimmy, is something wrong?
Yes, I've been out all day looking for a job, and when I came home, she was all dressed up fit to kill. I don't know where she got the money for a new dress, but she's got one. She's going out dancing.
Oh,
don't let her go, pal. Put your foot down.
Oh, I did.
She's going just the same.
Yeah, I see. Say, Duchess, I'd like to talk to Jimmy alone. We'll step out for a minute. Do you mind?
No. No, go ahead.
Okay. Come on, Jimmy. Jimmy, is she going out with another man?
Oh, I don't know, but I don't know what it'll mean if she goes out tonight, cuz this is the first time she's done it, and once she does, I'll lose her.
No, you won't, Jimmy.
I know I will. She's sick of staying in that hole, isn't she? Sick of not having pretty clothes, and not going out because I can't afford it. Oh, Kurt, I love her so much. I don't want to lose her. I was going to ask Grandma to come and talk to her, but she isn't here.
Tune in next week for the exciting conclusion. Good night, folks. And God bless each and every single one of you. Thank you.